be Tim Craft, who is the Deputy Medical Director at the Royal United Hospital in Bath. Tim is also an anaesthetist, and when he's not actually working in the theatre, or directing the hospital, he's also director of a company called AMS, which is essentially a medical devices company specialising in anaesthesia. Tim, I wonder if you could explain a little bit about how a practicing clinician has got into running a company selling medical devices.
Well, I think the answer, the glib answer in short, has to be by accident. It was certainly never a plan to set off down that route, but it came about really because of changes in clinical practice that were happening largely in the late 1990s, in particular in the United Kingdom. And that's around a means of administering anaesthesia directly into people's veins. It's called total intravenous anaesthesia, or TIVA. Historically, I think everybody thinks anaesthesia is to do with breathing gases. But a technique became available which was to anaesthetise people exclusively intravenously. Lots of clinical advantages, both as a practicing clinician but also from a patient's point of view, for having that style of anaesthetic. So that started to take off. We became very interested in it here in Bath. I think we like to think ourselves as being quite a forward-thinking department, and so quite early on got involved in practicing total intravenous anaesthesia. What worried me though, and I think others around me, was that the way in which we were connecting the pumps that pumped the drugs into people's veins were just inherently dangerous. And what we were doing was opening drawers in anaesthetic rooms and operating theatres and picking bits of kit and cobbling them together in a very kind of Heath Robinson fashion, which did not include what, to my mind, were essential safety features. So that led me, really, to sit down and say, well, okay, if what's out there isn't fit for purpose in our view, and yet this is a technique that we want to continue to develop, what do we need to do to make it safe?
And had you done anything like this before? It's a big jump from saying it doesn't work to I can do something about it.
Well, have I done anything like this before? Have I criticised things? Yes, yes, for sure. I guess doctors do that a lot, don't they? Criticise things they see around them. Had I done anything in terms of doing something about it? No. But I just felt that it wasn't right to portray ourselves as a very forward-thinking, safe department and continue to practice this particular style of anaesthesia unsafely.
So how did the process work? Did you start tinkering at home with the rubber tubing and so on? How did it all happen?
No, I had no idea what we were going to end up with in terms of end product, and didn't really pay much attention, to be honest, to think about what it might look like. We started off by sitting down with a blank piece of paper, getting a few guys together after work. It cost me a round of beers and several packets of crisps, and we just put it all down on a piece of paper. What are the features of a drug delivery system that we would want to see included to make it safe from a patient's point of view? And so that's a very sort of bottom-up driven design, really. In as much as it was a design, it was just a list of key features that the connector systems had to have.
But this wasn't just you, this was you and several colleagues, so this was a shared sort of input on if we could design a perfect one, this is what it would be like.
Yeah, they were colleagues who, like me, had become interested in TIVA, and who, like me, were concerned about the ways we were connecting the drug infusions to patients with intravenous fluids and different pumps of drugs. So what were we going to list as being the essential features of a connector system to improve patient safety? So that's how we started.
So we're in the pub, we've got a sketch of all the things that should be there. How do we move from that to a prototype and then to something in production?
And I think that's probably where I did sort of pull myself away from the rest of the guys, because, okay, that was a list and it cost me a few beers, but nobody was particularly interested in trying to do something about it. And I suppose that was a difference between, and remains, I think, a difference between me and most of my colleagues. What I then did was get together with a friend who, in fact, I knew from school, not from my school, but from my children's school. He has children, or had children at the same school. His background is finance and corporate finance. He's not a clinician at all. Said to him, I've got an idea for developing an intravenous connector system which could become commercially viable. Do you fancy helping me sort this out? And he didn't take very long to say yes. So having done that, we then had to go about taking this list of ideal characteristics to a medical plastics manufacturer and saying, we need to turn this into something that's palpable, something that people can hold and look at and test and say, you know, is this the shape of the connected system we need? So that was our next step.
And how did you handle the intellectual property question? Because even at that early stage, once you start showing it to somebody, there's a big question mark.
Sorry, no, sit down.
How did you handle the intellectual property question?
By a bit of a hit and miss approach, but by approaching a patent attorney in the city where we are at the moment, saying to him, we've got this idea, what about it? We then set off in search of a medical plastics manufacturer with a lot of agreements under our arms, which were to do with confidentiality and disclosure agreements. But again, quite accidental. You know, I didn't sit down and think, oh, before I have a conversation, I need to make sure I've got a disclosure agreement. We had those conversations with disclosure agreements in hand, but it more by luck than judgment. Mm-hmm.
And then this manufacturer was able to make up some prototypes. Did you then test them back on your colleagues, the ones who'd been in the pub?
Yeah, it took us quite a while actually to find a suitable manufacturer. I suppose I used my clinical knowledge of who makes what in the United Kingdom to pick a list of likely candidates. We then went off and had meetings with them and talked to them about their abilities and their interest in the project before we got anywhere near designing what would become ultimately the connector system.
And getting permission to use this or to test this in hospitals, that must have been an issue as well.
Yes, I think it is very difficult. I think what you have to do is have a leap of faith and go a long way down the track towards producing a fully assured and fully certified product to then use on patients. I can't see a way of getting there with something that you know that might be useful in the future, but let's have a go. It just doesn't work like that. So you can bench test prototypes in that form, but when you get to the stage where you actually want to use it clinically, I don't see an alternative to being a fully fledged CE marked product. You simply can't use even components or connector systems that aren't in the patient's body. You can't use them without being adequately CE marked and of course insured.
As a patient or potential patient, I'm quite glad about that. But then clearly one of the issues once you've tested this out and it does work and it is certified is getting your colleagues in the profession to adopt it. Can you talk a bit about how that process worked?
Well, I think it was relatively easy because we were dealing with a fairly blank canvas. There wasn't a good alternative available. So it wasn't particularly difficult to say to people, if you're using Teva, then we believe that this product that we've now designed as a consequence of this wish list that we put together is the right way to go. I think that might have been difficult if we were facing a lot of competitor products. Mm. You know, why choose this one over that one? But we started off locally, so in my own hospital, with a CE marked and assured product and testing it here really, costing the company that we then established, which by now was a limited company with public insurance policies and patent attorney fees and something that was costing quite a bit of money to establish, and then giving product free to people to test. So that's what we did here in this hospital.
And that was then, and roughly when were we talking about when you said
I guess the late 1990s.
Okay, and we're now in 2008. Can you tell me a little bit about the journey since then?
Well, a lot's happened. Firstly, the first manufacturing company that we formed an allegiance with have gone. We ended up with some prototypes, and we ended up from them producing products that were good, and they did establish a reasonable marketplace in the UK in particular. Had a lot of loyalty to the product, so once we got a product into hospital and it was being used, people didn't move away from the product. The problem was that they weren't big enough to move up a gear with us in the direction that we wanted to go. An example of that would be the injection mould process. We'd had some tools made which were good, and we owned the patent to a particular connector, or a particular component on the connector system. But the product that was coming out at the end of it could have been better, in terms of quality in particular. This is a piece of plastic hub into which pipes are glued. And if the plastic hub isn't completely smooth inside, then when the plastic tube is glued in it, you know, drugs and fluids will leak. And we were having little issues like this all the time. So to move the company and the business up a gear, we really needed to move to a different manufacturer. This happened at the same time as we were approached by probably the world's leading manufacturer of pumps themselves. Mm-hmm. And their pump sales staff were saying, we keep coming across this connector system in the United Kingdom, please can we have it to put with our pumps? Mm-hmm. And we'd initially said no. In fact, we said no more than once because we felt we were going to lose control of our business. Yeah. We couldn't innovate in the way that we wanted to. This is a global company that's owned out of an American base, and we saw all kinds of problems in working with a super tanker that couldn't change direction very quickly at all. In the end, though, they persisted and they said, we definitely want to work with your connector systems, we want access to your technology, to your patented technology, what can we do to satisfy you on this? And so we helped that relationship by moving to a new OEM manufacturer who was a manufacturer approved by this major pump manufacturer. So we did that very much jointly. Mm. They're based overseas, so they weren't an easy company for us to find, being based in the UK, so we used the pump manufacturer's knowledge of factories and manufacturers to find a company that's owned and based in France, but whose factories are not in France at all, chiefly because they take advantage of cheaper labour costs in other countries. Yeah. So the products are now made in Morocco, of all places, by a French-owned company. Still our own labelling, still our own badge, still our own design, but a company whose quality assurance processes are actually much sharper than the company in the UK that we were originally working with.
And in terms of innovation, you started off with this user-driven, this frustration with what was there. That gave you your first product or product range. How have you continued that innovative line?
I think in two ways. Firstly, you're right, it came out first of all with the first product, and that part of the innovation there was to turn that product into a product range, to hear end users say, this is good for this application, but on the other application we need something a bit different. So by listening to end users, we were able to grow that particular product range. I think we then developed a reputation for being a company that make products that end users specifically want, and can have some influence over in terms of final design, for instance. And so people started to come to us and say, well, if we just did that, or what about this? And so constantly now, get a fairly regular trickle of emails and telephone calls from people who say, I've got an idea, what about it? Most of them have not resulted in new products, but I think we're willing to listen. We've got a philosophy that says we'll meet anybody at least once. It's whether we subsequently go on to have a number of further meetings. I think what's, in terms of growing the company, what's particularly satisfying is that we have, again, fairly frequent phone calls from people who want to take our products for distribution in different countries, or in one case recently, actually want to buy the whole company. And so it's quite pleasing to have to be able to sit back and have people phone you and say, can we do some work together with you?
So it sounds like you've built a very successful business and in the process learned how to do finance, manufacturing, patent protection, a lot of other stuff. But if you were looking back now to the 1990s, what lessons have you learned? What innovation management lessons in particular? Things you might not do the same way again?
Well, I think of the two of us, the two directors that own the business, I'm probably the one that tends to be more pessimistic about what we're doing than my financially based colleague. And I think I should have had more confidence at the outset that the idea was a good idea and that it would produce a commercially viable product range at the end. And I was always, especially at the beginning, was always very nervous about the fact that we were sinking a lot of personal money into developing a business. And I think from my point of view, with pessimistic concerns about whether this was ever going to be worthwhile, there were several years of product design and development before we got anywhere near something that could be used clinically. And quite often you think, is it worth persevering? So I think the first thing was to have some confidence about what we were doing. I think the second thing is not to have fallen into the various relationships that I have done almost by luck, and to have a much clearer view of what you needed to do in terms of a pathway towards developing a product. And I suspect that for both of us, my co-director included, would actually have meant taking professional help. Seeking professional help from people that could have said to us, this is how you go from concept to commercially viable product.
Yeah. Yes, it does seem as if there's a number of complementary knowledge sets and you either bump into them by accident, or if you can, find professionals who can guide you or act in that role themselves.
Yes. I think I read a lot, and I continue to read a lot about the whole process of product and design and innovation, and have learned a lot from what I've read. I think I learned more from the relationships that we've developed with, you know, the patent attorneys, with the companies that manufacture. In particular, if I go right back to the beginning, when we set off with our wish list on a sheet of paper and found our way to what became our first manufacturing partner, I spent a whole day in a room that I'll never forget, surrounded by people that knew everything about medical plastics, about the components that they're made of, about the way that you sterilise them, about the way you glue them together, about their shelf life, but who knew nothing about their ultimate application. And of course, what we brought to the party was an understanding of what they would ultimately be used for. So taking that list of desirable characteristics into that room meant at the end of the day that we came out of there with sketches of what the end product would look like. And frankly, it's not radically different from what that very first sketch said to us. So for me, that was a real sort of light switch moment, big light bulb going on for me.
I think this fits very much in the Eric von Hippel model of user-led innovation. Do you feel now, after a long time being doing this, that you would be confident to advise one of your colleagues, perhaps in a different area in the hospital, who'd also got a bright idea, perhaps was frustrated? Do you think now you could help him or her move forward with their idea?
I think I could. I think the amount of help that I could offer would be fairly limited, though. I think my help might consist of seek some professional help fairly early on. I'm interested in ideas, and I'm interested in turning things into commercially viable ideas. I still get a buzz out of that. So I would be quite interested to talk to people about their ideas, but I think there's a limit to how far I could take them down that path.
I wonder, Tim, if we could broaden the conversation briefly. You also, apart from running a very successful business, continuing your innovating interests and, on the side, acting as an anaesthetist and a medical director. But leaving that aside, the NHS, the National Health Service, faces huge challenges, and clearly innovation, it's part of their sort of strapline, their slogan. It needs innovation in all sorts of directions, in products, processes, systems. Any thoughts about the challenges and any recipes for success or recommendations you might want to comment on?
To agree with you straight away that the NHS definitely needs to continue to innovate. I think it does innovate, but I think it needs to continue to innovate. I think what we've talked about so far is innovation at a fairly basic level, actually. It's innovation which results in a palpable end product. If I'm going to be rude about my own products, it's innovation that results in a widget. For me, that's kind of first base in terms of what innovation is about. I think what the health service needs is innovation which produces not just an end product that's palpable, but actually changing culture. So innovation in the way we think, innovation in the way we behave, innovation in the way we deliver care. I think if I talk to doctor colleagues in particular, when I talk to them about innovation, they imagine something shiny and metallic that fits in somebody's hip or possibly a drug. But innovation in the eyes of a clinician has a very hard end point. Yeah. I think what the health service needs is much softer innovation that is about cultural shift and change in the way we manage our processes as much as anything.
And the obvious corollary to that, what are the things that might be stopping that happening?
The inevitable inertia that a huge organisation like the National Health Service lives with. Some of that inertia, I think, is healthy. I don't think you want your health service jumping on every bandwagon that goes passing by. So I think there is some health in inertia, but I would balance that by saying we do have to keep improving and keep innovating and keep making things better. So we can't just stand and hold our current ground. And we've got to keep things moving forward. I think an example of where I've used that locally has been to say to colleagues that I think they can be forgiven for thinking, in the present climate in particular, that it's difficult to introduce new treatments or new methods of looking after sick people. I think colleagues may feel that litigation, that assurance, that the processes that are designed to assure patients and organisations actually are there to clamp down on improvement moving forward. I disagree with that. I think we have got to continue to improve and innovate. And so I've had a continuing dialogue with colleagues about that. I don't want to work in a hospital that doesn't innovate. I'm lucky I work in a hospital that does innovate. And I don't just mean in terms of the production of end product. But an example would be I said to my surgical colleagues that I want you to continue to introduce new operations into this hospital, but I want you to do so in a way that's assured and safe. And so I've helped them design a process which is nothing more than an algorithm which takes them through steps for how to introduce a new operation to this hospital. And so it has to do with whether what the indications are for this operation, what the training needs for you as a surgeon are before you can start this operation, what the training needs for your team are before they can start to assist you with this operation, what the patient's needs are, so what you tell the patient, what their needs are for in terms of understanding what the process of the new operation is, what the reasons for having it done is, and how they consent for that. And then finally, what the business case for this new operation is. And I do put that last. Mm-hmm. I think it's important that the National Health Service is not a charity, clearly it's not. It's important that we do make business cases for all the new treatments that we want to introduce. But for me, that's very much at the bottom of the stack.